This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunna Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 97 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we need you more than ever to listen. They're coming for you. But listen, your life could depend on this. Don't blink. Don't even blink. Blink and you're dead. They're fast. Faster than you can believe. Don't turn your back. Don't look away. And don't blink. Good luck. With me in the GPR studios this week is Jay.
Hey, how's
are you,
going?
Jay?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing good. And Keir?
Oh, hi, Haley. How are you?
Hi. And I'm Haley. A professional.
With words.
So, yeah, this week, I'm personally doing my best not to break down in sob and terror as we fill a listener request and take a look at the ultimate red light, green light players, the Lonely Assassins, better known as the Weeping Angels. This week, we got a voicemail from listener Wyatt, who actually, yeah, just had a request for us. So let's take a listen to that real quick.
Hi, my name is Wyatt, and I really love your podcast, and I was just wondering if you'd do an episode about Weeping Angels, because they're really cool. Okay, bye.
All right, so yes, we decided that we are going to fill that request. We do want to take a look at the Weeping Angels. These guys, you know, for new villains, they are immensely popular. I mean, they've only shown up in 3 episodes, and they're up there with Daleks and Cybermen in like every poll that you see.
Yeah. I don't know if I would go with Wyatt on calling them cool necessarily.
No, not so much.
If cool, you mean like blood chilling as a temperature sort of thing. Yeah. Then I'm right with you, Wyatt. But yeah, a fascinating addition, to the show over the last few years, and one that, rightfully so, really, you know, caught at the core of people's fears. Originated from a short story, that Moffat had put together, about Sally Sparrow. And just grew from there to the point where they are, you know, fan favorites, cosplay favorites. You hate driving past cemeteries if you see one of those statues. We've got a number of people in our neighborhood that has those nice little garden statues that I just want to go smash their heads off. yeah.
So have you guys ever heard Steve Moffat talk about like the actual first Weeping Angel that he found that kind of got the whole thing going?
No.
He said he was on vacation and he was walking past the cemetery and it was all chained off and they had tape up and everything saying dangerous. And he's like, you know, what's so dangerous about a cemetery? And he looks through and there's a Weeping Angel statue right through the gate. You know, and it's, I mean, the full pose that we first see it in. And, you know, it got him thinking. It's like, what could make a statue so dangerous? And this, that, and that's where the idea came from. And then years later, after Blink had already come out and the Weeping Angels were hugely popular, he was back on vacation in that same spot and was walking with his son. And he was like, hey, do you want to see the original Weeping Angel? And so they walked past there and the cemetery was still closed off and chained up and everything like that. And he was like, it's right there. And there was no angel. He said he and his son just kind of looked at each other and took off.
Yeah, yeah. And we've all come across, I mean, I know that there's a couple of locations here in the New England area where there are some museums that have various statues in various positions. I know there's one where it's the statue is the angel sort of slumped over a pedestal.
Yeah.
Just creepiest damn thing. But that's all we think about now.
Yeah.
Because they've just burned themselves into our memory. Strangely enough, angels burning themselves in your memory. One of their creepy abilities.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, these guys have only been in 3 episodes or 3 stories over 4 episodes. I mean, they've made a couple of other appearances, but there's only been those episodes that are angel-centric, really. You know, we've got Correct. Blink, right. Time of the Angels and Flesh and Stone, which was the two-parter, and Angels Take Manhattan.
Like, right. In increasing order of general... well, I don't know. Would you say that they've become more and more terrifying as you go on, or they've sort of peaked and now we're just learning more things about them that make them more complex and fearsome?
I would say they started as like a real visceral fear, and we've just learned more reasons why we should fear them.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I mean, for me, it kind of like was a reverse bell curve. Like they were really scary and blank, and then Flesh and Stone and Time of Angels, it was like, okay, still creepy as all hell, but not as bad. And then, you know, we get the Angels Take Manhattan and the creepy laughing cherubs, and yeah, back up there.
True, true. But then at the same point, within the same episode, you get to see like the conversion of the Statue of Liberty, and then, you know, there's that large group of people. Half the crowd says, wow, that's so awesome. I knew that was going to happen. Wouldn't that be just the scariest thing ever? And the other half says, isn't New Jersey keeping an eye on her? Really? Isn't somebody always looking at the Statue of Liberty to kind of keep it locked? But no, I mean, as far as what we've gotten in information just from the four stories, or from the four episodes, the three stories alone, these are very complex creatures. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there's still things that we have bound to learn. And you know, and that's one of the things we can talk about is are we done seeing them for a while, or is there any way that they're going to be incorporated? As if we could predict anything about the upcoming series, but is there still room for the angels to fit in there, with where the show is headed? So take us back to our first introduction to them, where we start to get, you know, a la the 10th Doctor giving us a really cursory, rapid fire, here's a need to know basis explanation of what the angels are all about.
Yeah. And I mean, that's where we get the whole speech and everything that we need to know about them wrapped up in about 15 seconds. You know, the doctor saying, look, they're quick. Don't look away from them. If they touch you, you're gone. End of story. And, it's a great way to sum up the villains. Mm-hmm. Now, that is one of the main arguments as to some of the inconsistencies, is that the doctor was just trying to relay information quickly and concisely and not give a whole, you know, encyclopedia of knowledge about them. So they're like, well, they never said they can't do this other stuff. So that's one of the arguments that comes up. But I mean, it's, okay. Yeah, everyone that has seen Blink remembers that episode. You can say don't blink and instantly anyone who's seen it's kind of like, what, wait, no, where, you know, you can tell.
Yep, absolutely. So from that episode alone, I mean, we start to get an understanding of at a biological level, what makes these creatures or this species so long-lived, and we start to get a good understanding of the basics of how they do what they do in terms of their survival. So we keep going around and around in the idea of them being quantum locked. So what exactly is that? You know, what does it really mean to be somehow tied to time?
That I'm not tied to time. I'm not sure, because normally every time I've listened to it, when he says quantum lock, he follows it up quickly with the explanation of how they can't move if they're being observed.
Okay.
So does that? I don't know.
Well, if the whole idea is that they have been around for so long, you know, we get the explanation they are nearly as old as the universe itself, but they have these tremendously long lives because all of the periods where they are frozen, you know, as we want to refer to it, they are actually not, they're not alive. They become stone, which gives them this tremendous longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Because at any point where they're locked, they are not aging, they are not starving.
Yeah, they're not alive.
Correct. So, but at the periods where they're in pursuit of something, you know, if they are traveling, whether it be, you know, across the surface, I don't know how they do any sort of, you know, interplanetary or interstellar travel. That aspect of it, I don't know, unless they're just freeloaders,
mm-hmm.
you know, or stowaways, you know, really scary ass stowaways.
But the worst hitchhikers ever.
Exactly. We told you not to stop for them. But if that's something where in the periods of pursuit, if they can't find a food source, and we'll get into what actually qualifies as their food sources, then they start to break down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got that good quote that you had tipped off on, Jay, where it's saying that, you know, when they're being observed, they don't exist.
Yeah.
So
that's the doctor tells it, and this is the from the dialogue with, or quote-unquote dialogue with Sally Sparrow. You know, he says, they don't exist when they're being observed. The moment they are seen by any other living creature, they freeze into rock. No choice. It's a fact of their biology. In the sight of any living thing, they literally turn to stone.
And that includes any living thing, including themselves, yeah, which is the other. Reason why they cover their faces when they're in a frozen state, so they don't accidentally look at one another and as a result, force each other to sit there and starve to death. So I guess that's where some of the inconsistency is, because if the idea is that they are not alive when they are locked, but yet one of the only ways that you can possibly defeat them is to get them into some state where they cannot unfreeze until they finally break down. Literally, the stone crumbles. We saw one of them start to break down. It was starving to death, and it looked like the statue was just falling apart. But in essence, it was actually the angel itself dying. That unless it has the opportunity to feed again, it'll crumble away, and job done. Good on you. So how are they starving if they're not actually existing while in a locked state?
Forgive me. It's been a while since I've watched Time of Angels, but there was no one else on that planet. It was just the angels, right? Mm-hmm. And did it actually say that they were like locked there because they saw each other? Because the only lights that we saw came from the people that came in. So it might have been, you know, pitch black, and they were able to move around because they weren't observing the others. Okay. And they may have been starving, and when they were deteriorating and emaciated. So when they switched to stone, it was a deteriorated form.
Hmm. Okay. No, I can move with that. Yeah. I don't know if that was ever really established, or whether the fact that they just resembled, or they took on the form of the statues when they realized that there was another now potential food source. Mm-hmm. By the time the Byzantium was boarded, I don't know. I'll have to go back and check again.
Yeah. The main problem that I have with that two-parter is when Amy is, you know, turning into a weeping angel, which we'll get into that in a minute. But she has to have her eyes closed. Otherwise, the angel in her eye takes over. So she's walking around and the doctor tells her, you know, just basically make them believe that you can see them and they'll stay locked. All right,
That makes no sense.
If it is part of their biology, if it is a reflex, or not even a reflex, if it's, you know, something built into their biology, then it's not a choice of, oh crap, she can see me, quick, turn to stone. It's, no, she'd be saying, I can see you. It's like, no, clearly you can't because I'm not stone yet.
Right. No, that's legitimate. That's when you cut to an action sequence really quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Distraction, smokescreen.
Although, one of the things that I loved about Blink was the fact that it never actually said anything about it, but anytime the camera was on an angel, it was almost like the angels could sense the viewer watching them, because they never actually moved when the camera was on them either. So that was really cool, and I really liked that because it was kind of meta. But then in Flesh and Stone, I think, I forget which one's which, but in one of those
in the two-parter.
Yes, the two-parter. We actually see an angel, like, you know, in stone form or whatever, and then turn its head, and that is one of the creepiest images.
So weird.
Oh.
Well, the whole idea that that's where things for me personally started to get, you know, infinitely complex was the idea of the camera capture, or the mirroring, the fact that you could forestall one by having it look at itself within a mirror image or see itself on a screen. You know, there's one of the novelizations, or not a novelization, but one of the extended novels that was written, one of the 11th Doctor and Amy adventures called Touched by an Angel, has to do with the idea of getting a bunch of them to see each other on closed caption screens. And so you got this big daisy chain of them all seeing one another on a screen. As long as those monitors are going to keep up there, you know, then you're okay. And the whole idea is that they slowly break down. They actually get dissolved into the screens, because that whole idea of just the same the way that they go into your, you know, your optical nerve and whatnot. So that, for me personally, started to get into some really kind of dodgy areas. You know, I like the purity of Blink.
Yeah,
you know, and the fact that it was just a matter of, okay, look at him to freeze him. They have a red light, green light game. Go with that, and if you can trick them into looking into each other, aces for you. You know, you're on the run. I think they're starting to get a little, or they risked getting a little overcomplicated with some of the sciencey wyancey side of this, because part of me in the back of my head says these things should be the scourge of the universe. Every species in creation should be terrified of these things. And yeah. It doesn't seem to be. It just seems to be that the doctor and his companions are the only ones really on the run, and the church to a certain degree.
Yeah.
So why are they not a much bigger, formidable force?
And see, to go back to Blink, there were only four of them. We only saw four. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, if that's all there is, like if it's just a handful of these creatures that, you know, just hitchhike around or whatever it is they do, then I can understand them being, you know, they're flying under the radar because they're such a small group. They're such a small threat. You know, they're not taking over planets or anything like that. But then, you know, and in the two-parter, we see, you know, hundreds of these things. It's like, okay.
You'd think it would be hard for them to travel in such large numbers.
You'd think.
Keep accidentally catching each other out of the corner of their eye. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I got to stay. Just stay in my blind spot. Just right. No, all right, we're all going to move
Don't
forward
at once.
Don't
break formation.
Are you looking at the back of my head? I think I just lost 5 minutes. Were you looking at the back of my head? Damn it, Bob.
Oh, jeez. Angel Bob. No, but I mean, some of the things that they introduced in the two-parter were really cool, though. It's like, okay, you know, they can take over people and use their voice to communicate because they're not going to be able to any other way. And I mean, I'm not saying that all this stuff makes sense, but it does add a certain factor to them.
Right.
You know, the fact that, you know, if you have them on a screen for too long, they can start coming out of the TV a la Ring. You know,
Well, I guess you look at their ability list, so to speak, and the means that they go about pursuing their food, you know, and by food, I mean, just, I'm not really understanding, you know, why the claws and fangs, when they're not actually, you know, chowing down on anything. That's a bit of an evolutionary oddity there. But if they're surviving off this temporal or time energy, and the idea of taking away the potential energy of what someone's life could have been, that whole idea of the touch sending you back and robbing you of what your future would have been, that unutilized energy is their source. Okay. All right, I get that. That starts getting into, you know, parallel universes and that sort of thing. I dig that. That's nice and complex. I can sink my teeth into it, no pun intended. but then you get into things like the fact that the touch, depending on what they choose to do with it, is either going to pop you back in time or is going to just immediately take all of your time from you, force you through the rest of your life, and turn you to dust, and just, you know, run you through the rest of your existence in the blink of an eye. So what's more tasty? Or what is the better means of their survival? Or I guess if it's something that they want to continue to live off of, like they did at the Winter Key, they just keep sending you back and looping you.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It just seems like they've added a lot of complexities to the species that each one in and of itself could be great to run with. The culmination of them all just makes it really kind of tough to know what it is you're running from.
Yeah, and that's kind of part of the problem is the fact that there's a lot of inconsistencies and a lot of, well, you know, here we have this, but here it says this. And it's difficult to really say, okay, what is the, you know, What is canon with these things at this point? You know, because things don't really jive. I mean, the whole way that they were, you know, killing people in the two-parter, you know, snapping their necks. It's like, okay, well, so at this point we understand they can choose to send you back or not.
Mm-hmm.
But why are they not feeding off these guys? Well, in The Angels Take Manhattan, we find out that a river says that it's too weak to send anyone back. So clearly it takes some sort of energy, some amount of energy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it might have just been, you know what? I'm not going to waste the time. I'm not going to waste the energy shooting you guys back because we know that they're after the reactor and the Byzantium. Right. So it's like, I'm not going to waste what little energy I have sending you back. I'm just going to snap your neck and
quick feed. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's, I don't know. I mean, things like that you can kind of like backpedal through and make excuses for, basically. But it's just really hard to say, you know, that they've stuck with the level of intensity that they had just because most of the time you're trying to figure out what's actually going on, you know?
Right. So I guess if you were to say, you know, where could you possibly go from here? you know, in terms of, you know, how do you continue to keep them, maybe not fresh, but keep them relevant and terrifying and all these things now that we've got, you know, the potential for inconsistencies that are going to, you know, cause the more, well, anal retentive of us to sit there and take these things apart, because we do. What kind of situations could we possibly be running into that just make, that give it a whole new aspect, you know, something that just makes it all kind of fresh again? And I actually, to a certain degree, I kind of like, you know, we say it as a joke, you know, it's t-shirt material at cons and stuff, but what about the silence?
Yeah.
You know, you made the joke about it, but you got a silent and an angel. The angel's frozen, doesn't remember that it saw the silent, so was it really being looked at? Could you remember you were being seen? What? Right. Yeah. Does the silent know what? But
that's the great thing. It's like you can play with it in so many different ways, and there's no correct answer with it. You know, it's, I don't know, but it's.
I would love to get some sort of a reference down the road that says that other species are as concerned about them as the human race and our one Time Lord. Mm-hmm. Because in any of the big gathering of the baddies kind of situations, you know, whether it be Time of the Doctor or going back to, you know, to Pandora or anything like that, they're there, but they're maybe not necessarily in cahoots. But they're there. Everybody should be freaking out over the fact that these things, you know, Centaurans could be, I do believe one of those strange stone creatures is behind us. I'm sorry.
Maybe they only feed on humans.
I need that referenced.
Yeah, I was going to say that's true. No, because in the God Complex, the weird creature thing that looked kind of like a mole, I think, Amy saw the angel in the room and thought it was hers, and he said, no, that was mine. This is what happened.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, they, like, took over his whole planet or something. I don't remember. I can't make myself go back and watch that episode again. But you know, we have gotten references to him, which kind of helped to fill in the blanks, but then other times, you know, like, with Time of the Doctor, that bothers me to no end. So there's weeping angels out in this forest where nobody's there. They grab Clara's leg, and she's still there. They didn't send her back. They get away and they run, and the angels just decide, never mind. I'm just going to stay here. The snow kind of makes this nice blanket. It's what the hell?
Yeah. Or that's when I think you get to the point where you know you want to have the reference there, but you've created a literary point, you know, this concept that could potentially be too large to wield within certain stories. Mm-hmm. So I just have to imagine that to a certain degree, the writers and producers have to look at this and say, we've got to be very sparing with how we choose to use this, because the more we throw into it, the more potentially, you know, unbeatable or the more complex we're going to have to make the script just to contend with how complicated and complex we've made the species. So I don't know. I don't really know if we're necessarily really going to get, you know, a whole angel-based episode again, or whether it's something where, you know, they're doing their, you know, our intrepid crew are doing their, you know, Scooby-Doo run through, and they happen to pass by a park somewhere where there's a couple of statues that have been pointed at each other, and the Doctor looks and says, yep, I took care of them a couple of years ago. They've still got a few years to rot. And they run on, you know. So it's... as fascinating as it is, I think it's equally problematic.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing, is it is such a great villain that the overuse of it, I mean, we saw the same kind of thing with the Master back in the third and fourth Doctor era, where because they brought him back so much, he lost a lot of that power. He lost a lot of the terror and the threat that he carried. And it was just like, oh, hey, look, here's the Master again. And yep, there we go. He beat him with a golf club. Whatever. Yeah. And it's, you're getting to that point with the angels where you're spending so much time, you know, focused on the inconsistencies or, you know, the trying to make sense of why they're there, that kind of thing, that you don't feel that fear anymore. You know, and I really think that the only way that they can get back to what it was is to, I hate to say this, but they can't address it at this point. They've done too much. I mean, all the different things they did in the two-parter, the, you know, ability to take over other statues in Angels Take Manhattan. You know, it's all of the stuff that just doesn't make sense with what we initially had, which caught, which created such a great villain. They basically just have to say, okay, we're going to ignore the fact that it happened, get back to the basics, and stick with that from this point on and not reference anything else. Because the minute that they try and explain it, it's going to sound so ridiculous that there's not going to be any point to even trying.
So the only thing I can think of is if you want to continue to touch upon them so that the fan base gets to enjoy how genuinely creepy and formidable they are without letting it completely unravel the story that you're trying to propel forward, is to either reference them in flashback or flash forward scenes. We have references in some of the whether it be the novels or in some of the compendium books that have been put out there, like the Brilliant books and those things that have been done that refer to past encounters with the angels, future encounters. You know, we're talking like 33rd century kind of stuff, where there have been these standoffs to whatever end, and maybe in a very Peter Jackson-y sort of way, we can but they could incorporate the one of the ways that either the Time Lords themselves had to contend with the angels in the past, because we know that they have. I mean, Rassilon even references them, when he was talking about the two doctors having to face one another as the angels did of old, there's material there to sort of touch upon it and say, this is for you guys to be able to enjoy quick little scenes, but it's an aside somehow, or the repercussions of some sort of crossing that was done with the angels that, you get to some situation, some time, some place where it's a wasteland or it's an old battlefield of sorts. And they have to refer to, the fact that there was a standoff with the angels, and you just see, arms laying about or a wing here or there,
I don't know. I feel like that would, the angels aren't made for action stories. They're not made for battles. They're not made for, for things like that. They fit well in the old style horror movie kind of episodes, like Hyde.
They're the thing that goes bump in the night.
Exactly. I mean, you take an episode like Hyde, where you never see the villain. They're there. You're just freaking out the whole time, and you don't want to see them very much, or you don't want an open conflict with them. Is like, oh, and their statue. Okay, I'm just gonna sit here and stare at you for 30 minutes. It makes for a boring episode. Mm-hmm. When they're the thing that's right off camera, that's when it works. So they need to focus on making those kind of episodes with them, and not the grandiose, we're going to have a grand standoff with these guys.
Right. Like the ones where they have to be outsmarted rather than just outgunned or what have you.
Right.
I always thought that there was the whole idea, there have been instances in the past where, as a result of some sort of a disturbance, whether it be, rifts or blips or overlaps within temporal streams and things, you had, you reference Hyde, you had someone who was slightly asynchronous. They were slightly out of step with present moment. And maybe that kind of thing can be used as a way to be able to contend with the angels, because if the angels are pursuing you, then you've got the opportunity to either be slightly out of step with them, and they can have more fun with it and sort of play with their pseudoscience that they do so well, rather than having something where, we've got to trick them into suddenly going into a fun house of mirrors and things, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen enough of those little comics sketches that people do of an angel coming at you, and once they're frozen in stone and they've got their hands out in front of you, you stick a little hand mirror in their hand and you're done.
Right. If it was that easy.
Yeah, it's like, oh no, look, hey, mirror, you can't move. Haha, I'm going about my business now. But I don't know, that it is possible to bring these guys back and make them. I mean, they're still terrifying. Mm-hmm. I mean, they may have lost a step, and it's not as nightmare inducing as it might have been the first time we saw them, but I mean, they're still scary. There's still plenty of juice left there, but it just seems like they need to be careful with it and handle it properly in order to not turn them into, Daleks. Cause we see the Daleks get beat so many times that at some point it becomes comical.
Right. Well, I guess it's really my concern is, you've got a terrifying, creation there. You know, you've got a form that just the thought of it, it has enough potential to be a good horror story. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily have to find ways to defeat them. It's a matter of just avoiding them. We never see any instance where they are outright beaten. You run every time.
Yeah.
So if that's going to be the case, then that allows them, if they're used sparingly, and you don't attempt to incorporate any more aspects, because the more you try to do to attribute something new to them, or give them some sort of a new ability, or to unravel something that we hadn't come up with before, so that you can come up with a new clever way to be able to sidestep them, there you're getting away from the core of what makes them just a pure killing machine.
Mm-hmm.
So overuse is a risk. But over-explanation is just as much of a risk.
You know, yeah.
Keep it simple. Keep it pure. Keep them creepy.
Yeah, and that's a great point. That, you know, the more you try and explain something, the less power it holds. Or, you know, the more people tend to get hung up on details. Like, if you think about, there was a zombie movie where they, yeah, in the original, it just, guy wakes up, boom, zombies. And you're like, oh, okay. All right, we've got zombies. Moving on. And then when they remade it, they tried to explain it, and they put in stuff like acid rain and this, that, and the other. And it's just kind of like, this doesn't work. You know, it's like
Return of the Living Dead.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so back in the 80s, Return of the Living Dead, they started saying it was a matter of, oh, you had a crematorium, and when they burned the bodies of the zombies, the smoke and the soot settled on a graveyard and reanimated them. Like, guys, can we just get back to the brains, please?
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, is, you know, the same kind of thing with Resident Evil at one point, where these people are in a graveyard, and I'm like, that's the safest place to be, because I understand the science of what creates these zombies, and I'm like, it wouldn't work if you're doing this and that and the other. And if you just say, hey, here's the bad guy, here's how it works, be afraid, it works brilliantly. When you try and explain this is why it works this way, then you're losing a lot of the punch.
Well, there's what it all kind of boils down to, is are you writing a story as a means to give a new spin on something, because you want to be clever in that regard and you want to say, look, I'm going to make you think about things you haven't thought about before? Or are you going to give us a situation where we know what the risks are, we know what the dangers are, and I want a clever way to get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's kind of where my hopes lie. You know, I don't want any more information about the angels. I want encounters with the angels where you find me new ways to run and hide, or, you know, live another day.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just give us a good story where it's scary and you're afraid of the angels. And then the end of the day, the doctor and Claire get to run off and, you know, live to fight another day. It's, I don't need to know their family history. I don't need to know their social makeup. It's not important.
Right.
Oh, but yeah, it's, I mean, the,
where do cherub angels come from?
That's the whole idea.
You don't want that episode? No, but
I think they gave us enough for that, though. They said the fact that you can incorporate, they can take over any statue and eventually turn it into an angel.
I thought those ones were just baby angels.
I think they just went to a lot of those peeing statue fountains and whatnot.
A lot of garden statues.
Yeah, those weeping angel babies should be peeing all over the place.
That would have been funny to put in, too. Oh, yeah, but I mean, the fact remains that these are terrifying villains. They're great, and they're, you know, the fact that we're still talking about them even after they've gone all Star Wars prequels on them, you know, proves how much power they hold. Yeah, so I would love to see them brought back carefully and done correctly.
Mm.
But I don't want Moffat to go all George Lucas and completely ruin him.
Right. Yeah. I don't want any more science. I want a good horror story.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if we've already been told multiple times that Series 8 is going to be darker and grittier and scarier, and great. Put a solid angel episode in there and fit the whole theme of that. That would be a great spot for it. So I don't know if we're going to see him again. I don't know if we're going to see him again properly, but I think that there's potential there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But thank you, Wyatt. Thank you so much for the suggestion on that one, because that's
absolutely, you
know, surprised we didn't take that one apart before. Maybe we're just intentionally avoiding it before.
Yeah, maybe so. But we did actually get a little bit of feedback, though, from Gracie Klein on our Facebook. We asked about what people thought about the Weeping Angels, and she said, "I think the Weeping Angels are the most terrifying of all Doctor Who's nemeses."
Yeah, I
have to agree with that. There's no other villain, no other monster that really scares me the way that the Weeping Angels do.
Mm-hmm. Because, well, either on one hand, you know, they've sort of written a lot of the fear out of the species. You know, the Daleks are not quite as formidable as they once were because people started realizing, well, just push them over. Just knock it over. It's a trash can, for crying out loud. Just shove the thing over. You know, the Cybermen are constantly, you know, going through their changes and things. And they sort of ebb and flow as far as their terror factor. The Centaurans have been completely undermined, you know, and have become kind of a punchline. And we haven't really
got the Slovene.
We do have the... excuse me. The sorry. Work on that one. But yeah, I mean, this is your terror du jour. I mean, they even took the Silence, who had a lot of creep factor going for them, and incorporated them and made them part of the church.
Mm-hmm. They explained them.
Yeah, I didn't want an explanation. So these guys have been kept relatively pure. I hope it stays that way.
All right, so that brings up a good question, because we got with the Silence and with the Angels, the explanation kind of ruins it. But then there's villains like, off the top of my head, like the Ice Warriors, where explanation really helps it a lot and makes you appreciate them more. So what is that balance? What are the kind of villains that thrive off of explanation?
Well, do you think that the explanation for the Ice Warriors was one that made them a more formidable enemy, or actually gave you more of an understanding as to why they were the nature of what they were?
That's a good question.
I think I almost empathize a little more with the Ice Warriors after, you know, the bit of a backstory that they incorporated, or that they sort of revived in Cold War. You know, for people that didn't really understand the whole idea of the you know, the terraforming Mars or any of the things that had kind of disturbed them in the past. Mm-hmm. But now you get some of that and you realize, okay, well, they kind of felt wronged, like the Silurians, you know, felt that they had absolute entitlement to the surface of the Earth. You know, we went dormant, now we're back. You know, this isn't an Indian giving thing. We're taking back what was ours. You know, you monkeys can just move aside.
Mm-hmm. So is it the enemies that get personified we're more likely to empathize with them, and we appreciate the information to help encourage that?
I personally enjoy stories where both sides of the conflict have a valid argument, or a near as. You know, you take some of the conflicts between Doctor and Master, and some of their best tete-a-tetes were the ones where they both had, well, you know, where the Master actually had something to throw back at the Doctor and say, aha, but, you know, can you not agree that this is in the best interests of, you know, or whatever the itemization was? Because as a viewer, I can say, all right, well, now I can see that this isn't just a matter of he's just, you know, not shaking his gloved fist at the sky and saying, aha, I will crush you all because I want to. It's there's something more to it. There's an actual motivation for the opposite side of the conflict.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I wasn't sure what where you draw the line as to, you know, which villains need the explanation, which ones are hurt from it. But
I think they both have their place. If they're going to be one of the kind of the sentient, the thinker kind of adversary, then I that's what I want. I want something where they're both kind of squaring off and they're trying to use their own perception of the logic and the reason of their argument. If it's something where I would just want to be, you know, hiding behind the couch, then I want the unencumbered killing machines, run as fast as you can.
Okay. So the visceral fear kind of things, you just want, here it is, be afraid, move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those are two very different stories and they both have their place within this universe.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, if you try to blur those at any point, you run a risk of losing the efficacy of one or the other.
All right. Good point. Oh, all right. But we actually do have some news this week. What do we got going on this week?
Well, you know, all of the cast and the production teams and everybody have been coming forth and just trying to reassure the public that this is, you know, you're going to be in it for some major changes. These are all due. You know, this is something that we've been building up to for a while. One of the statements that's been coming around there is the idea of the fact that we've been trying to compare or project what Capaldi's doctor is going to be in relation to any of his previous iterations. You know, we always want to draw upon and say, oh, it's going to be a little bit of the third, a little bit of sixth, and, you know, this, that, and the other. But beneath all of that, is it a matter of, you know, what kind of persona is he going to be putting forward? And you can tell me that it's going to be dark, it's going to be gritty, it's going to be scary, and all these things, and all the, you know, the usual line that comes out of Moffat's offices. But what does that really mean as far as the doctor's persona? And I think there's a, you know, we've got this interview with Capaldi where he's referring to them as, and he specifically uses the term that he is more alien than he's been in quite some time. You know, that he doesn't understand human beings and he doesn't particularly care about what the human beings think of him. Now, again, just like I just said, that's going to tell certain people, say, oh, that's going back to Pertwee. Pertwee was just like that, you know, or First Doctor. You know, what are you talking about, you silly man, you stupid police officer, and kind of scoffing at humans. Very alien. But I like the fact that even Capaldi's coming forward with saying that, because if that's what he's choosing to put forward his explanations for what he's been doing on set for the last who knows how many weeks or months, that's top of mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I do like the fact that he's trying to separate himself, and he's not saying, well, I'm playing it this way and I'm trying, you know, I'm drawing from this doc. Cause, you know, one thing that we got with Matt Smith a lot was he wasn't shy about telling people, no, I'm drawing off the Second Doctor. I love the Second Doctor. The bow tie is a reference to him. It's a, you know, all of that stuff is, you know, it ties into it. And here we've got Capaldi saying, look, these are the qualities I'm going for. I'm not trying to reenact another doctor. I'm trying to create my own.
Right.
So that does make it exciting. And I'm sure there's going to be parallels drawn no matter how far removed we get. But the fact that we will be able to look at it and say, this is uniquely Capaldi's doctor. That's exciting.
And it's actually driving the way that they have been describing the way that they're shooting and editing a lot of these scenes. They're turning this back into a science fiction drama. You know, they keep saying that they're actually making some of the scenes longer, so that moments kind of hang there a bit, you know, or the fact that conversations really have to be drawn out so that characters have an opportunity to sort of express what the situation is doing to them, or, you know, how it's manifesting in them, rather than saying, you know, they come running into the room and say, oh, there's trouble at the mill, and all of a sudden we cut to the mill. Mm. I want to know what that's doing in their heads. So if he comes out and he says, you know, he specifically says that the doctor is more alien now. Well, alien can be seen as something potentially threatening. It could be seen as something that's bizarre and otherworldly. It's something that's disconnected from the time and the place where he is. But at the same time, you know, go back and take, I'm going to use a really bizarre reference here. Remember the movie Starman?
Vaguely.
I'm going way back.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. It was before Haley's time.
But it was the whole idea of you've got an alien there that is sort of seeing things with fresh eyes, you know, so everything becomes a point of fascination. He may not necessarily like what he's seeing either. It may be something that disgusts him about the way the human species is or behaves, or the way the society or civilization has become. But at the same time, I mean, he says in one of his quotes there, you know, the doctor loves watching stars being born off in distant Andromeda, but at the same time, he's thrilled to just watch trash blowing across a parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an interesting way of perceiving who he is as this character. If that's one of the things that he's keeping as his backstory within his mind as he goes through these scenes and he's looking at it with this sort of this wonder or for these fresh eyes, that tells me that we're not going to be dealing with a, come on, let's go jump in the box, we're going to have an adventure, you know, and it's not, there's far more going on there. There's going to be so much more subtext.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is exciting. And I know of at least one person, and you know who you are, you evil, evil person, who has actually watched the first episode. He's got the leaked footage and he's watched it, and he keeps on dropping little hints saying that Capaldi is absolutely fantastic. And there's, you know, it's great and he's excited. And every time I tell him to, you know, shut up and, you know, but it's, knowing that going into this, it gets me really, really excited.
Mm.
And that's all I want to know. If anybody's seen it, I don't want to know anything else. That's more than I wanted to know, but you know.
Other news we got out there is obviously sort of kind of in keeping with it, and the idea, well, you've got the new persona, you've got the new approach, you've got the new way that they're sort of taking on the filming of the episodes, or maybe even the writing of the episodes themselves. Mm-hmm. But then you get down to, you know, back to kind of the minutia. You know, we talked a little while ago about the fact that Capaldi wanted to have some say in his costuming, but now there's been it was Entertainment Weekly, take it for what it is. It's kind of, you know, fluff as far as industry news goes. But, you know, rather than saying things about, you know, oh, tell us about the scripts and things, they go, tell us about your clothes.
Right. Who are you wearing?
Exactly. But he kind of, again, Capaldi steps forward and he says, you know, there's a reason why, you know, obviously, you know, we talked before about he wanted to kind of tip the hat a little bit to David Bowie and that sort of thing. But this is also a matter of he wanted to get away from shticks. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to have, you know, the umbrella, you know, question mark, or the scarf or the bow tie, things like that.
Okay. I like one of his quotes here. He says, I was keen to avoid items that can be fetishized and turned into merchandise. Like, and I mean, that's a great way of putting it. But the fez, the 3D glasses, the umbrella, the scarf, obviously, you know, there's a lot of that going around. Mm-hmm. But then again, at the same time, like he says he doesn't want stuff to, you know, it instantly to become a merchandise thing. But then later on in the article, they go into explaining. The article,
exactly, itemizes. He wears this coat, he wears this shirt, he wears these pants.
And it says right here, it says, you know, his coat comes from a company called Crombie, sales of which reportedly doubled after the first photo was revealed.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that kind of backfired, didn't it?
Yeah, really. But, you know, he gives a nice summary of some of the things that he put into the thoughts of his suggestions to the costume department, saying, you know, he attended art school, you know, he's a rock and roll fan, he likes German expressionism, which is very stark, very linear, very crisp.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted that to go into what he describes as a severe look. You know, everything, just hard angles, kind of, I mean, you look at him facially, his physical structure, everything is lean and tight. You know, he's got that jawline and the eyebrows and the whatnot that kind of bore into you. So that goes along with this, with everything we've been hearing about the way he's going about tackling a lot of the scene work. So again, just more stuff to get excited about.
Yeah. Oh, and then what's this last bit of news that we've got here?
Well, it uses your new hashtag, Jay.
Muffetsplaining!
We got some things Muffetsplained to us. Yeah, he's just a Moffat coming forward and basically saying that the whole idea, the reason why such dramatic changes are taking place, from the casting of an older Doctor to the dark tone of everything that's been released so far, and everything that we know about where the new series is headed, was done because he claims that it was this is an admission. I don't know, but he's saying that, you know, as soon as something starts to become comfortable, that's time to toss it all out and shake things up. I don't know if that makes sense.
You know, I can appreciate what he's getting at here. I can appreciate some of the stuff because, you know, he was saying that, you know, they noticed some of the humor was getting a bit glib. And it's there's definitely stuff that it has its course, it runs its time, and it needs to be. Yeah, you know, it needs to be redone. It needs to go away and bring something new in. You know, you have to keep stuff fresh. But at the same time, there's a point where you think, if it's not broke, don't fix it. You know, and I mean, this kind of goes back to the whole Weeping Angel thing that we were talking about earlier, that just, you know, there's no point in rehashing everything just because it's been a while. If it still works, then, you know, go with it until it does need to be refreshed. But again, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was getting a little long in the tooth. So, yeah, I can understand his desire to revamp some stuff. But again, like, you know, like we said, this is just Moffat-splaining. It's him saying stuff to generate headlines and create buzz. And we'll see what actually happens in a couple weeks.
I guess the thing that kind of trips me up on that sort of excuse is, you know, when you realize that you're becoming a caricature of yourself, it's time to toss it all out. Well, if that's the case, number one, why didn't you catch that a season ago when even your fan base was telling you that things were starting to kind of loop back on themselves as far as the patterns of the episodes or the nature of where the program had ended up? Or why don't you make it gradual? introduce new elements so that you're taking the familiar and twisting it a bit, and you can continue to make those little steering adjustments to keep the show fresh without potentially really screwing up your viewer base, as it could. And you know, you're concerned about the younger viewers, you know, the millennials or youngers, the teens and things that were really into the Smith era that have now come out and say, I don't want to follow this old man. I don't know what this is. So I don't know. Maybe this is just him Moffat's planning to kind of justify something that he's just decided to do or just came to the realization of. Or maybe he's that type that says, you know, run it out as long as it can go and then dump it all in its ass and start over.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or maybe he just hadn't said anything in a week.
I think she just nailed it.
It's going to be great. It's a cracker.
Oh, yeah. It's the whole thing that he quit Twitter. He got upset with Twitter and he quit. And so now he doesn't understand what the fan base is saying anymore. You know, because you go on Tumblr and it's all people that just absolutely hate him. And, you know.
You can always run to Reddit. They'll take care of you.
Yeah, well. Oh, that's about all the news that we've got this week. So next week we're going into series 8, and obviously with everything that happened in the Christmas special, the Time Lords are a big deal. They're back. They still exist. We're trying to find them. It's gonna come up. So we decided this would be a great time to take a look at the Time Lords, find out a little bit more about them, you know, take a look at the good ones, the bad ones, the just plain jerky ones, and really kind of dig into the minutia there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is something that gives us an opportunity to be able to say, all right, the hunt is on, obviously. Is this something, based on what we know of them, is this something we really want to see back on screen? Mm-hmm. You know, where have we come from? You know, what have some of the previous interactions been, positively or negatively? And is this something where, as we touched on this just a few weeks back about whether or not there's a risky run in having these this group of characters or this classification of your character base return to the program? So we'll do a little refresher. Themselves. Not all Gallifreyans, but just right. The Time Lords.
Yeah. Right. Well, this has been episode 97 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I made him say comfy chairs.
And this is Kier saying, I'm sorry. I'm very, very sorry. It's up to you.
And this is Haley saying, there's a difference between dormant and patient.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.
Whoa, spider!
What?
Die.
Aren't you, like, Buddhist?
Spiders don't have souls. Oh, but the moth is cute. You can live.